So without further ado, we'll announce our next talk.
Hello, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
I can hear myself, so that must mean something. Next up, we have Eric Davis. He's going to be doing a talk called Illuminating Pulp, Robert Anton Wilson's Paperback Esoterica. Eric Davis is an author, award-winning journalist, and scholar based in San Francisco. His work focuses on the intersection of alternative religion, media, and popular imagination. His cult classic, Technosis, Myth, Magic, and Mysticism in the Age of Information, which will be reissued with a new afterword this year. He also wrote The Visionary State, A Journey Through California's Spiritual Landscape, a short volume on Led Zeppelin and Esoterica, and most recently, Nomad Codes, Adventures in Modern Esoterica. Davis also explores the cultures of consciousness on his weekly podcast, Expanding the Mind, or Expanding Mind, on the Progressive Radio Network. He graduated from Yale University and is currently earning his PhD in Religious and Studies at Rice University. So I just want to say a personal note. I saw Eric speak in England at the Equinox Festival 6 years ago, actually, right before our first EDC, and was pretty blown away. So I'm really excited that he submitted a proposal and he was here to share with us. So thank you.
All right, so I'm going to attempt to talk without the mic. Is that everything okay back there?
Yes.
Is that working? All right, that's good. I'm really happy to be here. I've wanted to come since I heard about the conference, and a lot of friends have come and had a wonderful time, and I'm very excited to be here. And I'm excited about the questions that speaking here particularly made me ask about my topic, because it's something that I'm working on rather extensively. So here we have, of course, Robert Anton Wilson. First off, how many people have read Robert Anton Wilson? Yeah, there we go. Easy peasy. All right. No 101 necessary. I first encountered Robert Anton Wilson, or I first read him, in the summer of 1985, which was a highly weird summer for me. It was after my first year at Yale, where I was sort of rattled by the reality of East Coast privilege and all of that. I didn't know what I was getting myself in for, and I came back to California, where I'm from, and I lived in Berkeley with my high school girlfriend in a place called Barrington Hall. And Berkeley has a system of student-run co-ops, and most of them by the mid-80s were sort of, you know, pretty upright places, you know, good, healthy communities. Not so Barrington Hall. Barrington Hall held on to the sort of nasty dregs of the counterculture. It was filled with the speed freaks, junkies, the paranoid, the brilliant. It was a very strange, very powerful place. On the outside of the hall, they had the Lao Tzu line, those who know do not speak, those who speak do not know, or the reverse. Which, in general, when you hear it, is just kind of like an interesting statement about secrecy and knowledge and action. But somehow at Barrington Hall, it became highly ominous. What did they know? And you'd hear strange sounds at night, and the walls had, you know, 70s style graffiti, and the carpet smelled like cat piss. Anyway, this was the summer I decided to read Illuminatus, Cosmic Trigger, start my reading of Crowley, and it was a very weird time. I'm not going to go into any more personal detail, but I'm going to say that I did feel that, particularly in Berkeley, I received that summer some sort of initiation that I have carried forward even into my academic work. I'm writing my dissertation right now. It's called High Weirdness: Drugs, Media, and Gnosis in the Early 70s, and there's a big chunk of it on Robert Anton Wilson. But what I want to do before I get to Ra is to set up the story, this idea of illuminating pulp. And I'm focusing, in this sense, on the book, because we're here at a conference about books. And the relationship of books to the occult, and to being someone interested in the occult, to being an occult practitioner, now and then, is very interesting and very powerful from a media perspective. When we think about how culture changes depending on the kinds of media that we're engaging. You know, now we're in the digital era, we have social media, blah, blah, blah. All this stuff is changing. We can see it before our eyes, people's minds, how culture works, how people think about themselves. And so there's a way of looking at human culture where you sort of pay attention to the media involved and what are the logics associated with that media. And what we're talking about here, of course, is books. Because this is a bookish scene, guys. And I'm not telling you anything you don't already know. But if you look at modern magic, modern paganism, anybody you're going to find, they're going to have tons of books. And this, and the books aren't just because people tend to be nerdish and literary or English major types or whatever. It's because the books are actually source materials for the imaginative construction and reinvention of magical and pagan ways. So if we take it back a little bit, I want to introduce one other concept that's going to run with us throughout this talk, which is a certain polarity, a dynamic, which has different names, or I'll give it different names. And it's between, let's say, the high and the low, or the learned and the folkloric, the philosophical and the embodied, or the verbal or the material. So this dynamic, of course it has, in terms of magic, in terms of the history of the occult, of course it has very real historical substance. You know, we look back in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, you have learned people, mostly gentlemen, who are able to read, and they are doing certain kinds of work with certain kinds of books and material in certain kinds of social locations. And at the same time, out there in the field, in the hills and the dales, you have very other things, very different things going on in very different ways that don't involve books very much at all. It is interesting, however, in this glyph, that we do have some interesting kind of letters. So it's not as if we are outside of the realm of signs, as if it's somehow dumb. It's not dumb. It's just that it's not so fetishistically involved with the book. So, but the book in magic is a particularly interesting thing because it's a magic book. What does that mean? Well, it's a book that contains information about magic. Well, it could also be a book that contains, let's say in a sigil, magic. And it could be a book that itself is a talisman, that itself is an idol. So that's one way in which, you know, or these different kinds of ways in which books can be magic. But there's another way, and this is a way that I want to sort of introduce now, and again, we'll follow us through the talk. And that is the way that a magic book is a node in a referential network. A magic book is drawing off of other magic books and will itself become the site of a further construction and assemblage by other magic books down the line. And as these books talk to one another in this referential network, an additional layer of magic happens. And I'm just going to leave it at that vague sense, whether you want to be esoteric about it or whether you want to be psychological about it or historical about it. It doesn't really matter. Books talk to other books, and by reassembling these conversations, magic grows and develops. So there's this very interesting richness around the idea of a magic book. It's central to this practice. But already there's a difference, because the one high tradition, high magic tradition, is a tradition of books, and the low tradition is not quite a religion or a practice of books. So there's already this interesting kind of tension going on. And I want to throw out a general idea. There's a lot more you could say about it. It's a little bit bare and bald. But I think that what happens in the 20th century with modern occult practice is that we move from this dynamic where there's a very clear investment in high magic. Now I'm thinking of the Golden Dawn. I'm thinking of something of an extremely literate group of of, you know, writers and intellectuals and high-ranking people in society who are availing themselves to all this research that's being, you know, spewed up by the mechanics of 19th century British colonialism and the development of the modern university, and weaving together a new path that has a lot to do with books. But what happens over the 20th century is that other pole, the non-literate pole, the pagan pole, the atavistic pole, the feral pole, becomes more and more significant, setting in motion all sorts of interesting high-low dynamics until we're at a point now where I think it would be fair to say that we've reversed the polarity, that the magic that we're most interested in now, even though we still love books and we still love literature and we still love, you know, intellectual histories, et cetera, that we're getting closer and closer to the primal, the atavistic, the return, the deep, the ancient, the pre-modern, the uncivilized. And you can sort of see this, you know, announcing itself strongly with the development of chaos magic, which is not unrelated at all to the story of Robert Anton Wilson. So now let's move forward. Now, one of the because I think that this polarity of high and low is so important to 20th century magic, it's why I have a problem with the term esoteric. Now, I am a as an academic person in the esoteric studies, and it's an interesting thing in the field because there's still not really, it's still not really clear what the right word is. Is it the occult? Is it esoteric? In America, some scholars have described a metaphysical tradition within which one could locate these more explicitly magical and esoteric occurrences. And the way, part of the reason I think the term is problematic is that the farther you go back in time, and the deeper you go into Europe, the more appropriate the term esoteric is. However, the farther you go forward in time, and the deeper you go, and the more west you go in America, the less appropriate it is. Why? Because it's not inside. It's not hidden. It's not elite. It's out there. It's out in the open. Something else is going on. So what do we have here? This is a beautiful example of American esoterica. The sixth and seventh books of Moses, you know, a grimoire, a book of lore that was very important to the German Pennsylvania community. There was a lot of magic practice there inside the German community. The first English translation of the book emerges in about 1800. And then, peculiarly, over within a few decades, the book became extremely important and often referred to amongst hoodoo practitioners. So, who used it for all sorts of ways that its authors certainly did not intend. Now, this particular version comes later. It's redacted. You see this nice 50 cents each, seven for $2. Here's all the stuff you can get, and it's from Chicago. And Chicago plays an extremely important role in the development, the massification of esoteric information. This probably appeared in a catalog that was filled with spiritual supplies, often run by Jews who were selling to African Americans, and they would even sell them menorahs and other things. So you get this crazy American melting pot, high-low media transmission within which something like the esoteric current is flowing. And part of what I'm saying here is that something is also changing here, and that what's changing is that the very dynamic of high and low, of high magic and low magic, of learned philosophical angel magic and crude, atavistic, let's put hot pepper on their feet so I can get my boss off my ass, that kind of stuff. That dynamic, that is our current. That polar shift, that polarity is the current. And you can see this very much in the history of how esoteric and occult ideas are transmitted through literature. So, in other words, this high-low magic polarity is mapped onto media by rare, expensive, hardback books and pulp, available, cheap, well-distributed literature. So this is actually on pulp paper, which is, of course, the cheapest grade of paper, and that's where we get the term pulp fiction. So around the same time, and that was from the 20s, early 20th century is defined in part by this sort of mass expression or communication of previously esoteric elements. And amusingly, curiously, synchronistically, at the same time as this turn towards pulp esoterica, you have the rise of pulp fiction magazines. You know, going back to the turn, you know, really to the 1870s in the UK. But for our esoteric purposes, let's talk about Weird Tales. Let's talk about Lovecraft. And I'm sure that you are as familiar with Lovecraft as you are with Robert Anton Wilson, so I will do no 101 work. And instead, I will point you to a little interesting element of the Dunwich Horror, which very much expresses exactly the dynamic I'm talking about. So, it appeared in Weird Tales in April 1929. Wilbur Whately and his isolated rural family are declared to be of degenerate stock, and they practice strange rituals on the sinister Sentinel Hill, topped by an altar-like stone and featuring caches of ancient, possibly Indian bones. Well, in our high-low dynamic, we're definitely in the low here. But at the same time, Whately has to get the words exactly right, because unfortunately, all he has is a partial copy of the Necronomicon, Dee's translation of the Necronomicon. So he needs to get to the Latin to make sure the words are right. So he breaks into Miskatonic University in order to get his hands on the great grimoire, the book written in the original language. But for Lovecraft, that operation, that sampling of the high, that sampling of the literate, is an opportunity for more atavism. So it's already playing with this dynamic of high and low, and in so doing, introducing what I think is a fundamentally 20th century modern occult tinge flavor, style, approach that becomes more and more intense as the decades roll on. Gardner here is another great example, because in a way, in order for Gerald Gardner to put forward his project, he has to almost literally erase the traces of literacy from his project. What books informed him, what rituals he had read as literary items that he had recontextualized, and instead said, no, it comes from the earth, it comes from my experience, it comes from the forest, it comes from an old woman, et cetera, and it's found in the body. And even the way that the book functions, there's a book of shadows. Is it his? It's in his hand. Who gets it? It's this very different kind of book, a feral book, an atavistic book. And so you get this dynamic more and more rolling forward as you go through the century. Now, in the 50s, the paperback book emerges, and it really changes literature. Because now you have inexpensive copies, not only of all of the great classics, which get reprinted, but also, you know, weird stuff by Henry Miller and things like that. You know, it starts to open up a space for something else to go on, and it becomes much more intense or much more rich in the 1960s when the availability of information through paperback books and pocketbooks in particular feeds and fuels exactly the youth rebellion, because these guys don't have a lot of money, and now they can have their fingers on the material of the world. Another kind of book, I'll talk about the Lovecraft stuff or the Weird Tale stuff in a moment, but one of the kinds of books you can get, of course, is also academic books. Books that were previously expensive in the library, out of print, and now all the stuff starts to come back in print because people want it. So you can read Mircea Eliade talking about the sacred and the profane. And by the way, Eliade's definition of the sacred and profane is very much about this dynamic, because he's not saying there is the sacred and then there's the profane. What he's saying is the sacred is the difficulty of telling the difference, the impossibility of telling the difference between the sacred and the profane. The sacred and the profane, the awesome, the overwhelming, the mysterium tremendum is precisely that which fuses and confuses the sacred and profane, these very modern characteristics. So really what we're talking about is the sacred profane as one thing or one dynamic kind of element. Anyway, so all of this pulp literature came screaming back in the 1960s with these early Lancer and Ballantine publications snatched up by, you know, pot-smoking undergraduates and really informing the sort of aesthetic world within which more serious and focused forms of the occult would emerge. Here's Marshall McLuhan talking about the paperback book and relating it to TV, which he saw as sort of an evocative, resonant, rich, in many ways magical media, as opposed to the linear visual dynamics that had previously dominated the Gutenberg civilization. Not only is the paperback a tactile rather than a visual package, it can be as readily concerned with profound matters as with froth, high, low. The beatnik reaching out for Zen is only carrying the mandate of the TV mosaic out into the world of words and perception. The paperback itself has become a vast mosaic world in depth, expressive of the charged life sense of Americans for whom depth experience in words, as in physics, has become an entirely acceptable and even sought after. Now, at the same time that there's this paperback revolution going on, changing the way people read, there's also, of course, the occult revival, and particularly the instrumental role that publishing plays in the occult revival. Here's some very interesting statistics. In 1967, there were, according to this study, 198 occult, parapsychological, and astrological titles. 2 years later, there's 364. In 1968, there were 169 paperbacks in the same category in print. 1 year later, the figure had jumped to 519. So you have this explosion of literature, a lot of it republished and reprinted from the stocks. And this helped feed the fires of all of these people trying to make sense of their psychedelic experiences, their erotic experiences. How do we find maps for it? How do we take it farther? How do we play with this? How do we deal with the craziness of it? And it's a very rich world that kind of gives birth to this, to us. This is our world. There are the older people here remember what I'm talking about. Younger people here riding the waves of this, in some ways, literary, or in terms of books, literature, revolution. There's another quote I want to read from Richard Grossinger, a very interesting, if somewhat obscure, writer of the 60s and 70s era. I mean, he still writes today, but that's when he first started writing. And this is in the first edition of Tree, which is a really great, if you guys ever see a copy of this, it's sort of like Beatnik Kabbalah, edited by David Meltzer. Really good stuff. Look around, he says. This is not exactly Eden, but it is a garden. History surrounds us, and within that history, books. In Samuel Weiser's basement, there are books, of course, the great occult bookseller in New York. But the store is dusty, and flowers don't bloom there. The book's igniting for no one. It includes not stars and angels, but the most facile symbols, recipes for the most holy foods and metals, keys to all the planets on the levels of all the senses and bodies, tarot cards in several languages, adventures into the occult, lands where a door opens, where special maps are needed, purchased from Weiser. There are no sacred books in a sacred world. Therefore, there are sacred books. And then later in this piece, he writes, the moon is a letter. The moon on the water is a letter. The snake is a letter. This is literal. This is a pun. This is true. The letters of the alphabet that the Hebrew student must untwist, shape, and study are the creators, the seeds of the universe. They are the sperm, the atoms, the hydrogen. They are the hormones of sexual breath. They are the rhythm. They stand for nothing. R. You will find no further symbol at Weiser's, no extension of symbols, and a dirty paperback. as long as it is on earth where there are sacred books, is the Kabbalah. These are the instructions. So you can see here how the condition, not just of the re-emergence of all of this material in through publishing, but through the form of the paperback, through the low, through the pulp, becomes part of the ingredients, part of the stew, almost a kind of literary negretto that helps establish the kind of modern occult turn, or the last occult revival of the 60s and 70s. So now, with no further ado, there's some examples of that. This Vision of Voice is really one of my favorite packages from this era. I think this is from 1970 or 1971, and it just shows this desire to like lay it all on there, bring out every symbol you can, you know, thicken it. Let's go. It's a beautiful, beautiful design. And another sign of this occult, this high-low dynamics of the occult revival is, of course, the, again, curiously timed, not so synchronistic, emergence of an actual Necronomicon. Now, it's such a funny, you know, you could spend all day splicing the ironies and philosophical complexities of a real book that's based on a book that's not real in a pulp fiction you can play with that one yourself. But the point is that it's in this period, in the 70s, when in the wake of the psychedelic experience, in the wake of the occult revival, as people are trying to make sense of their lives after having blown them out for years, if not decades, using these esoteric materials, that you find the emergence of this pulp book, some of which are actually not very pulpy at all. So these are two different editions of the Simon Necronomicon from a few years before that. That was the Owlswick, which was the first Necronomicon. And I love this because you have this very desirable, hard, oh, beautiful cover. I really want that. But that's the one I had. I don't know about you guys. I remember buying that one when I was, you know, like 14, that blew my mind. So there you have it, the high-low, the pulp returning as a source of true esoteric wisdom. And I'm just going to give you one other slice from the finer edition, only because it kind of points to about where we're going to go right now. That's right, Mr. I on the triangle. I had never noticed that before, and until I was putting together this slideshow, I was like, oh, that's very interesting. And he would think it was interesting, too. So Robert Anton Wilson, well, how am I going to get into? Let me just see. Okay. So to talk about pulp or to talk about low literature, there probably could be no lower literature than pornography. And in the 1960s, Robert Anton Wilson was working for Playboy as an editor and working on the letters pages. And forgive me if you guys all know the story, but we have to do a little bit of it. And it's during this time that he encounters a character named Carrie Thornley. And it's a long story, but basically, both of them were very interested in libertarian politics, and at this point the Playboy Forum was actually a host for a lot of discussions about personal freedoms and the government, and there were people writing in with kind of conspiratorial ideas, and this was very interesting to Mr. Wilson, who loved these conspiracies. Carrie Thornley came on his map because he was interested in the same kinds of things. And then something very weird happened to Carrie Thornley, who's a fascinating figure. If you're at all interested in this stuff, Adam Gorightly's book on Carrie is really, really a great one. Is that in 1968 he was indicted by the crazy, marvelous New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison for his supposed involvement in the assassination of JFK, because Garrison was sort of running with they didn't get it right in the Warren Report. We got to right this historical wrong, and he sort of became a kind of conspiratorial prosecutor drawing in all of these people. And Thornley has all sorts of other peculiar connections with Garrison. He knew Oswald. There's all sorts of strange, high weirdness lurking in the story that I'm afraid we're going to have to leave to the side for now. But the this indictment was the precipitating cause of what Thornley and Wilson called Operation Mindfuck. And it went like this. Thornley figured out that there was a guy in Garrison's office who believed that the ultimate source of the assassination of JFK was the Illuminati. And the Illuminati at this point is already part of right-wing conspiracy theory. It's established, I'm going to space her now, Nesta Webster's book, World Revolution from the 20s, and then the John Birchers in the late 50s and early 60s, they went all over this Illuminati stuff. And so the idea behind Operation Mindfuck was to plant seeds of pro-Illuminati material in public places so that it would feed the fuel of this crazy guy. So they concocted this letter exchange in Playboy form, like, I have heard that the JFK assassination is from the Bavarian Illuminati, and they started to like elaborate this joke about, this real joke about the Illuminati, and they did that in a couple of different magazines as well. Simultaneously, there was a student group in Berkeley who called themselves the Bavarian Illuminati and started playing similar games. All of this was really part of what readers from the Illuminatus would discover is part of the Church of Discordia, the idea of Discordianism, which Carrie Thornley and Greg Hill concocted in 1958 in a bowling alley in Downey, Southern California. Which Downey is also the source of Taco Bell. Oh, and there's another one, and I'm blowing it. Shoot, there's another fast food restaurant from Downey. So Downey's cultural source, very important. And, you know, Discordianism, if you're not familiar with the Principia Discordia, I highly encourage you to take a look at it. It's basically a joke religion that's not quite just a joke. I'll read a description of it from something I wrote. Discordianism holds that chaos is at least as fundamental to reality as order, and that it should be honored with paradox, contradiction, principled anarchism, and an irony or even sarcasm so profane or so silly that it suggests somehow the sacred. It's that dynamic again. Go low to come high. You can't tell. Are they serious? Well, they are. But if you try to point out where it is, it eludes you and draws you further into the game. The principal Discordian text, originally published in 1965 in five copies, and by the way, mimeographed on Jim Garrison's copier machine in New Orleans. It just keeps going. It's this parodic collage of cartoons and quotes and beatnik Zen and tongue-in-cheek religious language and a deeply irreverent strain of American vernacular humor. And there's lots of kind of conspiratorial playfulness. But it's really important to see that this stream of Discordianism, including Operation Mindfuck and including the kinds of things that Wilson would go on to do, is also a media practice. These guys were zinesters before there was a zine scene, and they produced their materials collaboratively using assemblage and collage, so different people would put different elements in, they would obfuscate their actual names, and the Principia Discordia was also published, one of the first things that's published under a copyleft idea. So there's many, many versions of the fourth edition of the Principia Discordia because other people just went, oh yeah, we can just do this ourselves and take out these pages and add these other pages and do something else. So again, there's a media strategy. There's a way of engaging with literature, with writing, with how we produce writing that creates certain kinds of possibilities. Possibilities that at this point, in the late 60s for Wilson, were largely political and satirical. Mixing a kind of libertarianism with a countercultural hatred of the bourgeois and of the right-wing power structure. But things get more complicated. In 1970, I believe, Alan Watts, no less a figure than Alan Watts, turned Wilson onto Aleister Crowley. And Wilson became a huge fan of Crowley, and now there's all these new books that were just coming out. It wasn't a lot in 1970, but there was some. You could get Regardi, you could get The Confessions, you could get Vision of the Voice, you know, you could get Book of Lies came out in 1970, and Book of Lies was his favorite because it was so punning and full of encoding and multiple voices, very inspiring. That doesn't mean necessarily that Wilson's first writing project was that sophisticated. In fact, it is a piece of pornography. There's just no way around it. It's a pornographic paperback. Now, there were a lot of science fiction writers and other writers who were writing pornography in the late 60s and early 70s. They were like often sold in head shops or in sex stores. But they often had a lot of crazy drugs and weird ideas in them. And I'm curious how many people have read this. Okay, not too many. If you like this stuff, if you like Illuminatus, it's actually great to read, especially because that means you don't have to read Illuminatus again, which is, you know, 1,000 pages long, and there's a lot of slog in there. It's brilliant, but it's, whew, you know, it's a tough ride. This, on the other hand, is very short. It's funny, and it actually contains many of the most explicitly magical ideas that will be important to Illuminatus. In some ways, even better, because he's being a little bit less tricksy. He has less room to throw multiple stories at you as he does in Illuminatus. In the same year, and this kind of sets up something about Wilson's own career, in 1973, there's a figure in here who's a magician, does black magic, says very intelligent things, mixes ideas from John Lilly's metaprogramming with Crowleyan ideas, and it's at the heart of it is really what we heard about in the last talk, which is sexual gnosis. And it's kind of funny, I feel sort of awkward putting this up here after the last talk when we heard such true words about how distorted our sexuality, occult eroticism is by the existing phallocentric cultural order of which the sex machine introduced here and her naive face, and it's all part of the same thing. But curiously, Wilson himself was actually not at all a cheesy guy in that way. His wife was an ardent feminist. It's very complicated, actually. When you look at the way that he presents sexual magic in his texts, it has a very different valence that I think is much more in a line with a post-Crowleyan development that turns away, that adds a lunar element to the solar current. But anyway, in 1973, he also published the book Sex and Drugs, which is on the Playboy Press, which is, and the header of it, I think I have an image here. Oh, I can't quite read it. It's sort of basically like, does drugs make sex better? Let's find out. You know, which reminds us also that that's a lot of what's happening at this time. I mean, it's, you know, there's so much power in eroticism. There's so much power in sexuality. Even if you don't have any mystical idea in your head, you don't know anything about sex magic or moving channels or kundalini or any of that stuff, getting high and having sex is pretty potent stuff. So you have this revolutionary energy floating around amoral, anarchic in the culture, and it's being organized and shaped through these cultural narratives. And so Wilson was very good at shaping this kind of countercultural psychedelic eroticism into something magical, because this book is mostly, or the really rich parts of it, it's all about magic. It's all about esotericism. It's all about the idea that hidden within all of these different systems, there are techniques of altered states, state change that can be amplified through drugs and can be amplified through sex, and they lead towards forms of gnosis, which are perfectly available and accessible to you just because you have a nervous system, has nothing to do with religion, and let's go at it, you know. So it's a very interesting book and very symptomatic of the times with the cheesiness and the paperback quality, but it once again shows how from this pulp, from this low, comes something much more than that. Now, here's the Illuminatus. This comes out in 1975. Now, one of the irritating things I'm working on the Illuminatus trilogy is that the claim is that they mostly wrote it from 19. He and his and Robert Shea, who was another editor at Playboy, mostly wrote it from 69 to 71. And Wilson's own personal experiments with LSD and Sex Magic and Crowley really get going around 1971, and they kind of lead into the high weirdness that would define his life in the mid-70s when these books came out. But they didn't, since they didn't come out to 75, it's really hard to tell, like, is this from the older part, or what's he doing? So it's kind of a melange. So it's better just to think of them as coming out and having been written in the early 70s. Beautiful, marvelous covers, which also communicate some of the power of the pulp, which is, of course, also the comic book, the garish, you can draw a connection between this and, you know, placards at freak shows or something, that kind of excessive intensification. There's no way to talk about what goes on in the Illuminatus trilogy except to say that there's the Illuminati, who are sort of bad and doing something, trying to control the world in some way. And then there are various forces that are fighting the Illuminati, most of whom are associated with the worship of the goddess Eris, who is the main goddess in Discordianism, which we always have to remember is technically a goddess religion because of the role that Eris plays. And it's just a crazy book. It's extremely experimental. It's very postmodern. You know, characters change mid-sentence. It's first person, it's third person, there's citations that are woven into different verses. I mean, it's very postmodern, but it's completely unpretentious. There's no literary pretension. It's not like Gravity's Rainbow is kind of the closest analog, which is also full of high-low. There's tons of low stuff in Gravity's Rainbow, but Pynchon was definitely going for the gold ring of literature, and Wilson was not. Inside the book, there's a lot of self-reference in the book, and there's one point, there's this snarky guy who's writing a book review for the magazine Confrontation, and he's writing about this book that's really describing Illuminatus. So he says, "It's a dreadfully long monster of a book. The authors are utterly incompetent, no sense of style or structure at all. It starts out as a detective story, switches to science fiction, then goes off into the supernatural, and is full of the most detailed information of dozens of ghastly boring subjects. And the time sequence is all out of order and a very pretentious imitation of Faulkner and Joyce. Worst yet, it has the most raunchy sex scenes thrown in just to make it sell, I'm sure, and the authors have the supreme bad taste to introduce real political figures into this mishmash and pretend to be exposing a real conspiracy." Later he says, "If The Lord of the Rings is a fairy tale for adults, sophisticated readers will quickly recognize this monumental miscarriage as a fairy tale for paranoids." So again, it's a beautiful ride. Some of you have done it. It's a bit of a slog, whatever. It's a great thing. But what I want to sort of highlight, and how much time I got? Till
about 10 after.
10 after. Okay. All right. I'm just going to read, just to pull one thing out of Illuminatus and then go on to Cosmic Trigger, is, again, how much of the magic of the book, because my argument is that these are the grimoires. It's not the fancy re-editions of, you know, like Jimmy Page's version of the Goetia from 1975, which is all in like goatskin and it's beautiful. And yeah, that's cool. I'm glad it's there. I own one because I wanted it. But these are the grimoires. Well, I wrote about Jimmy Page and Led Zeppelin. I had to get it. I mean, it was like the transmission thing. You know, I was not going to write that book about Led Zeppelin 4. I was like, no, I was doing another project, and oh, I can't do it. And then I had one of those dreams, you know. I was sitting there. I was playing guitar with Jimmy. There were all these black candles. It was kind of spooky. And I woke up, and I went, oh, shit, I got to write that book. Anyway, so I just want to say is that how these grimoires work, how they communicate their magic to you, is through this high-low dynamic. And I have two quotes, but I think, well, I'll read this one. So, no, I'm not going to read that one. Here we go. Towards the end, there's this crazy, florid piece of writing that's just experimental. It's not even really narrative anymore, but it captures this mixture of high and low. "For the front line, clear as claritas was Mescalito from my peyote visions." And this Wilson actually did have visions of Mescalito, peyote was his first psychedelic, which I think he took in as early as 64. So it was Mescalito from my peyote visions, and Osiris with enormous female breasts, and Spider-Man and the Tarot Magus, and good old Charlie Brown and Bugs Bunny with a Tommy gun, and Jughead and Archie and Captain America and Hermes thrice blessed and Zeus and Athena and Zagreus with his lynxes and panthers and Mickey Mouse and Superman and Santa Claus and Laughing Buddha Jesus and a million, million birds, canaries and budgies and gaunt herons and holy crows and crowley hoes and eagles and hawks and mourning doves, for the morning never ends. And this is that kind of mixture, that kind of craziness, and also the idea that there are secrets buried in the low. This is that sacred profane, that it's precisely in your capacity to see the esoteric behind the lowly, behind the merely pulp, behind the merely pop culture, that sets in motion this dynamic. I think, by the way, that this dynamic is not the case now, that we've changed, we moved into a different space. There's elements of it, but we're actually in a very different zone, partly because of digital technology. But in the counterculture era, in the post-counterculture era, in the 70s, into the 80s, through the zine scene, it's this marvelous, marvelous high-low line. One other little bit that plays with this esoteric pop culture stuff. At one point, Simon Moon is telling Joe Malik that Weishaupt, the founder, the actual historical founder of the Bavarian Illuminati, discovered the Law of Fives, this marvelous law that organizes the book, and out of which we pull the magic number 23, which is another mimetic virus that once you are exposed to, you cannot escape. Not unlike Lovecraft. But we'll leave that one alone because it's a recondite matter. So Weishaupt discovered the Law of Fives while he was stoned and looking through one of those Shoggoth pictures, you know, you saw in Arkham, because earlier they had gone to see the Necronomicon. He imagined the Shoggoth was a rabbit and said, "Du Hexenhasse," which has been preserved as an in-joke by Illuminati agents in Hollywood. It runs through the Bugs Bunny cartoons. "You wascally wabbit." But out of that schizo mixture of hallucination and logomania, Weishaupt saw both the mystic meaning of the five and its pragmatic application as a principle of international espionage using permutations and combinations I'll explain later. That same mixture of revelation and put-on is always the language of the superconscious. Whenever you contact it, whether through myth, magic, religion, psychedelics, yoga, or spontaneous brain nova, maybe the put-on or nonsense part comes from by contamination from the unconscious. I don't know, but it's always there. And it's partly to spread that contamination that they wrote these books. In fact, in the appendix, Wilson and Shea write, "This book, being part of the only serious conspiracy it describes, that is, part of Operation Mindfuck, which I earlier talked about, has programmed the reader in ways that he or she will not understand for a period of months or perhaps years." That is, the books are designed to draw you into a certain way of thinking about these relationships between high and low, between irony and seriousness, between mystical experience and absurd revelry. And that if they're working, then suddenly you kind of begin to see your pop culture position in a very different way, your relationship to books, your relationship to literature. And I think this is a legitimate, you know, parodically, it's a legitimate esoteric current, but it has an extra little bite to it, because when Wilson wrote that, he had not yet been bitten by the bug. He was still kind of controlling this playful, exuberant collage of all of these different myths and political positions. But as we find out from this amazing book, Cosmic Trigger, Final Secret of the Illuminati. This is the first Andor edition, which is 77, and in which he relates basically the experience of all of these esoteric conspiracies around 23 and the Dog Star Sirius and Crowley and Hawks and all of this weird interlinking self-referential and referential material that's in Illuminatus. Remember at the beginning I talked about part of the magic of magic books is the way that they refer to other magic books and they get this network flowing, and a book like Illuminatus is full of references. It's full of allusions of books, of things that are true or things that are made up, and you can't tell the difference. He's playing with that referentiality as a kind of magical spell, really. But it takes over his life. and he goes through a period of time. He's doing heavy sex magic with acid and Beethoven on really loud and doing Rite of the Phoenix, doing all sorts of stuff. And there's a period of about a year, he says, where he's convinced that he is being communicated to from an alien intelligence associated with the double star system Sirius. And so basically his ability to maintain the ironic distancing that partly allows the wonderful craziness of Illuminatus to happen as a literary artifact, he is no longer actually able to sustain in his personal life. And the story, this is what he calls Chapel Perilous, that point in your practice, that point in your life where you realize you've crossed a certain line. And the minute you cross it and you turn around, that way back is not there anymore. And we all know this. This happens in small ways, it happens in major ways, and it happens in quasi-psychotic ways. I mean, to be frank, I think a lot of what people do, what we do with magic, is to flirt, dance, engage with our own potential for psychosis. Now, there may be other things going on there, spirits, wisdom traditions, et cetera, et cetera. But one of the things we're doing is to play with that edge and try to draw creative juice out of it and try to not have it swallow us up. So this book really tells Wilson's story of going through that and then coming out of it. I just had to throw this in here because the book also has these wonderful, wonderful illustrations in it from John Thompson in very 70s, you know, dense sci-fi comic book, head shop, psychedelic poster art, full of density. And this citation from Crowley in some ways captures a lot of this whole sacred irony that Wilson is talking about. In this book, it is spoken of the Sephiroth and the paths of spirits and communications of gods, spheres, planes, and many other things which may or may not exist. It is immaterial whether they exist or not. By doing certain things, certain results follow. Students are most earnestly warned against attributing objective reality or philosophical validity to any of them. Now, Crowley himself did not always, in fact, often did not heed these words himself, but that is another matter. For Wilson, who in many ways framed Crowley for the occult revival and for the post, you know, 60s embrace of Crowley as it goes into chaos magic, as it goes into, you know, modern thelema, goes into zine culture. And he brought forward a particularly let's say, instrumental or skeptical Crowley. And I think he did that partly because there's a lot of reasons to talk about it, which we don't have time for now. I want to wrap it up so at least we can get a couple questions. But one reason is because once you suspend the they may exist or they may not exist, then everything is in the field. Fictions, history, philosophy, your own dreams, your own sexual experiences, cartoons, Mickey Mouse, Thrice Great Hermes, it's all in the field. And so suddenly the high-low is destabilized. And we're forced in a explicitly libertarian way for Wilson to come up with our own way, to not rely on masters because the masters are just figments of the same hallucination. Instead, we got to do it ourselves, either individually or in groups. And he was not adverse to groups at all. He practiced with people in the New Reformed Orthodox Order of the Golden Dawn in the mid-70s around the same time. So I just wanted to... thanks, Bob! You know, I'm sure some of you feel that way. Again, we probably just have like 5 minutes or something, so thank you for your attention. Comments, questions, concerns? Yes, sir.
Understand why he complicated everything so much. Could he have done it any other way?
That's an interesting comment. I hadn't thought about that. I could see Leary saying that.
Yeah.
Because Leary, I mean, Wilson was deeply influenced by Leary, and Wilson was one of the rare people who actually read Leary, meaning that he recognized that he was always an intellectual, whatever else he was. Almost everybody else is, oh, he's just this clown, he's exploiting people. But Leary had very strong ideas that had this kind of skepticism, this kind of esoteric, ecstatic skepticism going on. So Wilson really learned a lot from him. So that's an interesting comment. It's like Wilson, I don't know, that's funny. What do you think about that? Do you think he overly complicated it?
I think that Leary was referring to the fact that this was after a kind of trigger and after Illuminatus. And I think Leary knew Wilson before he wrote a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
Much more
sensitive. Yeah, in the 60s.
And then, you know, in the 60s, that the group of places like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Things were not, they were laid back, yeah, so to speak. And then all this business with the conspiracy thinking, you know, that's in the Nixon era.
Right, right. Yeah, it was very, very, very complicated zone. Yeah. Look, something else? Yes, sir?
You mentioned almost as a throwaway line that you think that the sort of Illuminatus trilogy, 70s psychedelia, is not where we are today.
Mm-hmm.
Can you elaborate and expand on where you think we are?
You know, I'm not. It's much harder. You know, it's much harder to get the map when you're in it. I do think that the digital culture and the internet has fundamentally destabilized the high-low dynamic. So in the 70s, you could go into a weird thrift shop in some small town and find all sorts of marvels that were not recognized. And now almost all of those things are online. They're put into a sort of market logic where you sort of have a rough idea of how much they're worth. And there's sort of a leveling of high and low. And at the same time, the power that pop culture had as a kind of low, counter-normative, punk rock, fuck you kind of element, which goes through the 80s, it increasingly becomes absorbed into the way that mainstream popular culture operates, such that you can't really find... It's like now we have... You know, there's fundamentalist Christian bikers, surfers, snowboarders, comic artists. You know, I mean, that distinction hasn't really happened. So we're in a different kind of web. And the relationship to objects and therefore to physical objects, to books, to comic books, to pulp, to high and low, is all very transformed by the internet. And how to go beyond that, you know, that's a whole other kind of question. But I do think it is an actual shift. And I think you see it even in the way that spiritual practice happens. For example, like in the, you know, reading the history of paganism in the United States, you know, 60s, 70s, groups, people coming together were incredibly important. Now, they were also doing forms of communication. They really fuel the zine scene from a religious point of view, incredible private press stuff going on in the pagan scene in the 60s and especially the early 70s. And so that, you know, kind of carries forward into the internet. But the whole relationship to gathering and people, it's still there. Obviously, all the old analog world is still with us. But the larger cultural dynamics, I think, have changed really significantly. And it'll be interesting to see in just one generation what covens look like, what gathering looks like. I think it will be very different than in even, you know, our generation, even though I know we're from different ages. I think we're done. One more? One? Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you. I want to point out that you get a book about Thornley and Garrison and Lee Harvey Oswald. It's a new book from Carroll House called Caught in a Crossfire. We got it upstairs just back to the printer.
Oh, it's out.
Yes.
Yeah, oh, excellent.
I want to give you a copy.
Great.
So
score.
Also, I knew Bob Wilson a bit before he died. He was such a generous, yeah, beautiful man.
Yeah.
And he did an introduction to the book, biography about Jack Parsons.
That's right.
It's called Sex and Rockets. He got that upstairs too. So.
Absolutely. Well, he really recognized, he was in how Parsons was such a significant libertarian thinker as well as an important esoteric thinker. And yeah, Bob was a real, I got to meet him a couple times, and super sweet guy. Man, I wish all libertarians were like that. Wow, we'd be in a different world. Wow, you know? What's that?
Not Austrian.
Well, he always had a sympathy for the working class, unpretentious, didn't worship money. You know, really, really a very interesting guy. I think we're done. One more? No? No one's telling me? All right, bye.